Introduction. This e-compendium provides a brief overview of the topic, nursing patients with heart disease. It is expected that you have already completed the lesson in anatomy and physiology to review cardiovascular disorders. To accompany this resource, it is particularly important to study the curriculum, other textbooks, articles and clinical skills resources to gain complementary knowledge. This study programme provides you with the opportunity to increase your understanding of the subject matter, answer study questions, and to deliver evidence-based nursing when working in clinical practice. Learning outcomes. After studying this subject, the student should be able to explain the normal function of the heart and factors which are affected by these, anatomy, physiology, pathophysiology, pathology, and pharmacology. Explain important observations and nursing measures for patients with cardiovascular disorders. Observe, check, and document key parameters and deviations from these parameters. Assess the response of the patient to nursing interventions and the patient's nursing need in acute and chronic heart diseases. Assist the patient to regain optimal function and prevent long-term complications. Documentation of observations and nursing actions. The structure and function of the heart. The heart is divided into right and left chambers and is separated by the septum, heart septum. Each half of the heart consists of an atrium and a ventricle, which are separated by connective tissue. The myocardium consists of striated muscles. Myocardial tissue inside the heart is covered by a thin membrane, the endocardium, which consists of a single layer squamous and connective tissue. The exterior myocardium is covered by the pericardium, consisting of two layers, the inner, visceral, and the outer, parietal. Between the two membranes, pericardial, there is a thin liquid film which allows the two layers nearest to each other to move smoothly relative to each other. The heart has four valves. The tricuspid valve is between the right atrium and right ventricle. The pulmonary valve is between the right ventricle and truncus pulmonary. The mitral valve is between the left atrium and the left ventricle. The aortic valve is between the left ventricle and aorta. These valves work so that blood can normally pass in a direction from right to left of the heart. The myocardium is supplied with blood through the cardiac vascular system, and heart contractions are controlled through the conduit system using electrical impulses. Diseases of the heart. Diseases of the heart can be congenital or acquired, and are caused by changes in the heart and blood vessels. Children and young adults rarely encounter acquired heart disease, but may present with congenital heart defects. Acquired heart diseases are related to lifestyle and can be prevented by changing lifestyle behaviours, for example, by stopping smoking, losing weight, or increasing physical activity. The most common heart diseases are ischemic heart disease or acute coronary syndrome, hypertensive heart disease, heart rhythm disturbances, arrhythmias, heart valve disorders, mitral, aortic stenosis, aortic insufficiency, heart inflammation, cardiomyopathy, endocarditis, myocarditis, pericarditis, and heart failure. This chapter will focus on ischemic heart disease and heart failure. General nursing observations and clinical assessment. An accurate and rapid assessment is required when a patient is presenting with chest pain or cardiac symptoms. This assessment should follow the ABCDE principles: airway, breathing, circulation, disability, exposure, or environment. Additionally, a full clinical history should be obtained, including a 12-lead ECG, physical examination, blood tests for cardiac enzymes, and a risk profile of the patient. ABCDE principles. ABCDE principles are: A. Airway. B. Breathing. C. Circulation. D. Disability. E. Exposure. Important observations are: Airway. A. The patient can have a clear airway or have something that is blocking the airway, such as the tongue, dentures, mucus, saliva, or foaming liquids such as pulmonary edema. To ensure the airway is maintained, the patient's head should be held in a neutral position. The nurse should check if there's noisy or troublesome breath sounds, remove any debris from the oral cavity, lift the jaw forward by pushing the jaw. If necessary, an airway should be inserted by an appropriately trained member of staff. Breathing B. The nurse should assess the movement of the thorax, depth of respirations, frequency and regularity of respirations, use of auxiliary muscles and breathing position, supine and relaxed or upright and forwards. Respiratory rate. Normal respiratory rate for an adult is 12 to 16 regular breaths per minute. Tachypnea means increased respiratory rate and is observed in patients with heart failure, pain or anxiety. Decreased respiratory rate is observed when the patient is sleeping, has reduced consciousness and or by the effects of certain medications, for example, morphine. Dyspnea means laboured breathing. In cardiac patients, this can be due to the failure of the left ventricle caused by congestion with blood in the pulmonary circulation, and it often occurs in heart failure. The role of the nurse is to assess the degree of dyspnea at rest. Orthopnea is laboured breathing in the supine position and therefore commonly arises during the night due to the accumulation of blood in the pulmonary circulation. It is therefore beneficial for cardiac patients to be nursed in a semi-recumbent position supported by two or three pillows to reduce the load on the heart. Functional dyspnea is when a patient is breathless on minimal exertion, and this results in reduced ability to undertake activities of daily living. Breathlessness at rest is a very serious symptom of heart failure. Both functional dyspnea and breathlessness at rest may also occur in patients with lung conditions. Cough, hemoptysis, and bloody sputum can be signs of heart failure, pulmonary embolism, or mitral valve disorder. Rattling breath sounds and pink frothing sputum may indicate pulmonary edema. Chain-Stokes breathing is characterized by periodic deep respirations followed by apnea, and this may occur with severe heart failure and in the terminal phases of illness. The nurses should observe the patient for changes in respiration, including if the patient is becoming increasingly short of breath or if respirations become labored and rattling. To assess if the patient is hypoxic, the nurse should record pulse oximetry and blood samples should be taken by a trained member of staff for measurement of blood gases. Circulation, C. Pulse rate is an important observation when assessing the patient's circulation. The nurse should count the pulse frequency, regularity, and pulse character. Normal pulse rate is approximately 65 to 80 beats per minute and is steady and regular. A pulse rate over 100 beats per minute is called tachycardia, and a pulse rate below 60 beats per minute is called bradycardia. Because of varying preload in the left ventricle, the heartbeats may be different in strength. In cardiac arrhythmias such as atrial fibrillation, patients may have an irregular pulse. A weak pulse may indicate a reduced stroke volume and ejection fraction, percentage of left ventricular end diastolic volume, and increased systemic resistance, vasoconstriction. It is therefore important that the pulse is counted manually and not only by means of a monitoring device. The pulse should be counted for a full minute. The radial pulse can be palpated at the wrist and is the most common site to record pulse rate. If, however, the systolic blood pressure is less than 80 millimeters of mercury, if the patient is in shock, or if there are presenting symptoms indicating that the patient has suffered a cardiac arrest, the pulse should be palpated in other arteries, namely the brachial artery, the femoral artery, or the carotid artery. The pulse is affected by the following factors: age, gender, activity, hormones, pain, anxiety, temperature, blood pressure, nausea, and physical exercise. The pulse rate is regulated partly by the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, hormonal and electrolyte balance, concentration of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the blood, and possibly by the content of drugs or toxic substances. Blood pressure is defined as the pressure exerted against the blood vessel wall, and it is not uniform throughout the cardiac cycle. The distance from the heart, the size of the blood vessels, and resistance in vessel walls affects blood pressure. Blood pressure decreases on the way out of the left ventricle and out to the body, and is at its highest in the arteries, falls sharply in the capillaries, and is almost zero in the large veins. Arterial, capillary pressure and venous pressure refers to pressure in the vascular system. Normally, blood pressure in adults is defined as less than 130 over 85 millimetres of mercury. And if blood pressure is 140 over 90 millimetres of mercury or higher, it is classified as hypertension. Several physical factors affect the arterial blood pressure, including cardiac output, peripheral resistance, arterial elasticity, blood volume. Arterial blood pressure increases with age, but a blood pressure higher than 140 over 90 millimetres of mercury is unfavourable in all circumstances due to cardiac stress. Systemic blood pressure is recorded indirectly, non-invasively, using a blood pressure device, while direct blood pressure, invasive, is measured directly in the bloodstream by means of an arterial tap. The skin should be observed to assess for changes in circulation. The nurse should observe skin temperature, whether it's dry, damp, cold or hot, presence of cyanosis, bluish pallor and colour, on the lips, around the mouth, oral mucosa, conjunctiva, earlobes and nail beds. In patients with dark skin, the pallor of the skin may be seen as ash or more yellowish brown, depending on the colour initially. In patients experiencing shock, the skin becomes cold and clammy due to reduced renal blood flow. Peripheral circulation is assessed by observing the patient's arms and feet, by comparing skin temperature, symmetry, edema, pigmentation, ulceration and scarring. By pressing a fingertip against the patient's nail bed, the nurse can examine capillary refill. This should normally occur immediately, but in patients with reduced peripheral circulation, it may be more than 2 seconds. Central venous pressure represents the pressure in the vena cava near the entrance to the right atrium and is an expression of the right ventricular end-diastolic filling pressure. CVP provides an indication of intravascular volume, volume in the bloodstream, and is commonly used to control intravenous fluid therapy. CVP in an adult is from 4 to 10 millimetres of mercury, or 8 to 12 centimetres of water. Low CVP suggests that circulating blood volume is too low or declining. High CVP suggests high intravascular volume, hypervolemia, caused by rapid or too much fluid intake. Elevated CVP is seen in right-sided heart failure after a heart attack or high vascular resistance in the pulmonary circulation. In left-sided heart failure, the CVP may rise and eventually congestion can be visibly seen with possible pulmonary edema. ECG or electrocardiogram is a method for recording the heart's electrical impulses through electrodes placed on the chest. This is an important tool to identify heart disease and to monitor heart rhythm. The measurements performed are presented in a curve, an electrocardiogram showing the time measured in seconds. In normal ECG measurements, 6 electrodes are placed on the chest, which are precordial ECG electrodes. However, for the diagnosis of ischemic heart disease, a 12-lead ECG is used. The method can reveal where myocardial ischemic damage has occurred by showing cardiac activity from different angles. Disability D. Elimination. The nurse should assess fluid status of the patient. Urine production is a measure of the patient's renal function, but also an indication of cardiac function. In the event of pump failure in the heart's function, circulation is prioritised to vital organs such as the heart, brain and lungs. This results in less blood flow to the kidney and decreased urine output. Normal urine output is approximately 0.5 mL per kilogram body weight per hour. When urine output is less than 400 mL per day, this is called oliguria. Anuria is the term for urine output less than 50 to 100 mL per day. In such cases, a urinary catheter may be necessary in order to measure hourly urine output and the effectiveness of diuretic medications. The nurse must observe urine colour and odour, record a strict fluid balance and assess for positive or negative fluid balance. Measure hourly urine output. Exposure, E. Consciousness. Due to reduced circulatory blood volume, patients can experience symptoms of hypoxia, which presents as confusion and agitation. The nurse should check the levels of consciousness using the Glasgow Coma Scale. This is a scale where the nurse assesses the degree of reaction to sensory stimuli. The scale is mostly used for head injuries, but can also be used for cerebral alteration of other causes. Oxygen saturations should be assessed using pulse oximetry. Chest pain. Chest pain in heart disease is caused by a lack of oxygen, ischemia, in myocardial cells and occurs when the coronary vessels become narrowed due to atherosclerosis. The pain occurs when there is an imbalance between oxygen supply and oxygen demand of the heart muscle. Angina pectoris is characterized by severe retrosternal pain with radiation to the left arm, neck region, and lower jaw with duration of 1 to 5 minutes. The pain commonly occurs during exertion and can be relieved following use of glycerol trinitrite spray or tablets administered sublingually and the person ceasing exertion. The nurse must observe the intensity of the pain, distribution, localization, duration and depth. Map the patient's experience of pain, what relieves or aggravates the pain, and the degree of anxiety. Observe the effectiveness of medication. Multiprofessional approach to patient care. When the patient is critically ill, the nurse must undertake a systematic observation of the patient's condition and ensure a fast response with the implementation of evidence-based nursing interventions. It is important that all members of the multiprofessional team are involved in the patient's care, and this requires a coordinated approach to implement effective communication. An evidence-based tool used to facilitate timely and effective communication in the multiprofessional team is the SBAR tool. Situation, background, assessment, recommendation. The tool can be accessed via the link below. Nursing observations and clinical assessments in specific cardiac conditions. Acute coronary syndrome. Acute coronary syndrome is an umbrella term for all ischemic heart diseases that are caused by a reduced blood flow to the heart. It includes the following conditions: unstable angina pectoris, non-ST elevation myocardial infarction, or NSTEMI, and ST elevation myocardial infarction, STEMI. A diagnosis of ACS is based on the presenting symptoms and a comprehensive clinical history. The symptoms are commonly associated with a rupture of an arteriosclerotic plaque within the coronary arteries. This leads to the formation of a thrombus or blood clot in the affected vessel by a process of platelet activation, adhesion, and aggregation. In unstable angina and non-ST elevated myocardial infarction, there is a partial occlusion of the affected coronary artery by the thrombus, which reduces the oxygen supply to the myocardium. It is this reduced blood supply that causes the ischemic chest pain. Changes can be seen on ECG, but changes are not necessarily always present. There will be raised cardiac enzymes, which will be indicated in blood tests. If the blood vessel is totally occluded by the thrombus, this is known as ST elevated myocardial infarction. There will be ST elevation present on the ECG and raised cardiac enzymes. The myocardium is starved of oxygen and nutrients, resulting in death of the affected heart muscle. Risk factors for development of coronary diseases are divided into modifiable and non-modifiable factors. Modifiable risk factors are physical activity, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, smoking, obesity, and stress. Non-modifiable risk factors are age, family history, and gender. Unstable angina and myocardial infarction without ST elevation. NSTEMI. Signs and symptoms. Patients experience a non-ST elevated myocardial infarction typically present with precordial or retrosternal chest pain that is commonly described as heavy, crushing or burning and radiates to the neck, jaw or arms at rest. Patients can also experience back pain. Pain tends to persist for more than 15 minutes and can be accompanied by nausea, clamminess, vomiting and dyspnea. Unstable angina has a similar presentation to a non-ST elevated myocardial infarction, but occurs when the patient is at rest or with minimal exertion. The duration of pain associated with unstable angina tends to be shorter than non-ST elevated myocardial infarction. Importantly, the presenting symptoms of a non-ST elevated myocardial infarction and unstable angina cannot be distinguished from an ST elevated myocardial infarction without confirmation based on a 12-lead ECG. Medical treatment. In acute care settings, the priority should be an accurate, comprehensive, and rapid assessment of the patient's presenting symptoms in order to instigate evidence-based treatment options. This includes a 12-lead ECG, physical examinations, risk factor profile, and blood tests for cardiac enzymes. Patients diagnosed with unstable angina or a non-ST elevated myocardial infarction require the following interventions as a matter of priority. Intravenous analgesia, morphine or diamorphine, to be given by an appropriate trained healthcare professional. Nitrates, aspirin, clopidogrel, heparin, beta blockers. Exercise. Consider the nursing care that the patient requires when admitted to the acute care setting with chest pain. ST segment elevation, STEMI. The condition is most commonly caused by an occlusive thrombus in a coronary vessel, resulting in complete occlusion of the oxygen supply in a part of the myocardium, causing necrosis of the myocardium, death of cardiac muscle. The incidence of ST-elevated myocardial infarction increases with age. Diagnosis is made based on symptoms, 12-lead ECG, and blood tests. Cardiac markers, shown in the blood results, or rise a few hours after the infarction and remain high for 7 to 10 days. Echocardiography shows reduced movement in the ventricle as signs of ischemia or necrosis, and coronary angiography will indicate the degree of occlusion in the coronary arteries. Signs and symptoms. Patients commonly present with chest pain, which is retrosternal and is not relieved by nitrates. Nausea and vomiting are common, and the patient may feel sweaty and clammy. There is a risk of sudden death following an ST-elevated myocardial infarction within the first few hours because of serious arrhythmias, heart failure, shock, and rupture of the heart muscle. The most life-threatening arrhythmia is ventricular fibrillation. Patients often describe an overwhelming sense of doom and are fearful of dying. Longer-term consequences of an ST-elevated myocardial infarction include anxiety and depression with altered self-esteem, concerns about the role in the workplace, in the family, and fear of the future. Medical treatment. Tissue damage occurs in the first 4 to 6 hours after the chest pains begin. It is therefore important that the patient receives revascularization therapy to open the narrowed blood vessels and to reduce the extent of damage to the myocardium. Delayed treatment increases morbidity and mortality. Fast hospital admission allows for revascularization using primary percutaneous coronary intervention, or PPCI, and this should be undertaken within 90 minutes of arrival at the hospital. Revascularization with PPCI reopens an occluded coronary artery with a catheter. Both the radial artery and the femoral artery are used as insertion sites for the catheter. The radial artery is associated with fewer complications, but is more technically demanding than the femoral artery. A balloon is inflated inside the occluded area of the artery. The vessel expands and a stent is inserted in the area to keep the vessel open and to prevent further occlusion. If PPCI is not available locally, patients should be treated with thrombolytic therapy, clot-busting drugs, within 30 minutes of onset of the symptoms. Revascularization with thrombolytic therapy dissolves the thrombus so that the blood supply to the damaged area is increased, thus reducing ischemic damage and aims to preserve the myocardium. Nursing patients with acute coronary syndrome. During the acute phase of ACS, there is a need for continuous monitoring of vital signs, and therefore patients should be treated in a specialist cardiac unit. Specialist nurses should observe and assess the patient continuously during this acute phase and liaise regularly with the multiprofessional team. The aim is to implement nursing interventions to reduce cardiac muscle oxygen demand and to increase the oxygen supply to the heart. In the acute phase, it is important to implement nursing care to assist the patients in their activities of daily living whilst encouraging self-care. The nurse should guide the patient and family about the long-term implications of coronary heart disease while supporting the patient to maintain their autonomy and independence. Observations. Observe respiratory rate, depth and pattern. Patients experiencing ACS may be hypoxic with dyspnea, therefore oxygen therapy should be considered. Prescribed oxygen can be administered to increase the oxygen saturation levels in the blood and can limit ischemic damage. In some cases where patients have developed cyanosis, pulmonary edema and possibly shock, they may require greater amounts of oxygen. Patients will be confined to bed for 1 to 2 days to reduce the oxygen requirements of the damaged myocardium. Pulse oximetry should be recorded to assess oxygen demand. There should be regular observations of blood pressure, pulse, skin, temperature, fluid balance to assess the effectiveness of treatment of nitrates, beta blockers and diuretics, and any complications. The nurse should administer and observe the effectiveness of the following prescribed medications. Analgesics should be administered as prescribed and the effectiveness of the medication monitored. Chest pain and infarction pain are associated with severe pain. Chest pain causes stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system, which increases heart rate, elevates blood pressure, thereby increasing oxygen demand with increased risk of myocardial ischemia and increased risk of arrhythmias. It is important that the patient's pain relief is optimized to mitigate these reactions in the body and reduce patient anxiety associated with chest pain. Morphine is the most commonly used analgesic for chest pain due to both its analgesic effect and effectiveness in reducing anxiety. Additionally, morphine has a parasympathetic effect, which causes dilation of veins and reduces resistance in the pulmonary circulation. This in turn reduces the oxygen consumption and thus overall cardiac demand. Morphine is administered intravenously by a healthcare practitioner, with a maximum effect after 8 to 10 minutes, and this can be optionally repeated after 5 to 10 minutes. The effectiveness of the analgesia should be observed, and the nurse should liaise with the medical team to discuss the patient's progress. Nitrates cause a vasodilation of coronary vessels and peripheral vessels. This reduces the venous return to the heart and thus the cardiac workload. This means reduced oxygen demand and reduces the risk of heart failure. The medication is usually administered intravenously on the first day of treatment and then administered in tablet form or transdermal patch that is gradually scaled down. It is important that following administration of nitrates, the patient's blood pressure is monitored. A low dose should be prescribed initially, which is increased gradually until it reaches the optimal effect on pain and blood pressure. In significant hypotension, the nurse should promptly report this to the medical team. Reduce the supply of medicine, tilt the bed end, and possibly administer fluid therapy. When the patient is pain-free sitting out of bed, they can begin to mobilise and will hopefully be able to be discharged home between 5 and 7 days. During this phase, the nurse must offer appropriate support with activities of daily living. Patient education, cardiac rehabilitation. Following an episode of ACS, patients should be referred to a cardiac rehabilitation program. Cardiac rehabilitation aims to support patients to modify risk factors, increase physical activity, and offers psychosocial counselling when necessary. In most cases, patients should be well enough to resume normal activities at 4 to 6 weeks post-discharge, with a return to work usually after 12 weeks. More information about cardiac rehabilitation programs can be accessed via the link below. Pulmonary edema. Pulmonary edema can be caused by fluid overload following an acute myocardial infarction or in a patient with chronic heart failure. Patients describe feeling extremely short of breath and may fear that they are about to die. Nursing care of the patient with pulmonary edema. The patient should be positioned upright, supported by pillows, or if necessary, they may need to be nursed sitting in a chair. 60% humidified oxygen should be prescribed and administered according to local policy. If necessary, continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP, should be administered as prescribed by the medical team. CPAP treatment is a continuous positive pressure in the airways, which provides resistance and displaces fluid in the lungs. Treatment should be initiated as early as possible and effectiveness of the treatment documented in the nursing records. IV diamorphine and IV furosemide should be administered by the medical team. The patient may require an infusion of furosemide. Complications of pulmonary edema are cardiac arrhythmias. If the patient experiences life-threatening arrhythmias, they will be prescribed antiarrhythmic medication or may require cardioversion. The patient will be cared for in a specialist cardiac unit with continuous monitoring of the patient's condition by specialist nurses until their condition stabilizes. Exercises. What is hypertension? There may be an infarction in all organs of the body. What is a heart attack and what are two major causes of infarction? What are the causes of coronary heart disease? What presenting symptoms do patients with ACS have? Heart failure. Acute and chronic heart failure. Acute heart failure describes a patient who presents with sudden onset of shortness of breath and pulmonary edema. This is often following an MI or an acute valvular problem. Chronic heart failure is a complex syndrome that can result from any structural or functional cardiac disorder that impairs the ability of the heart to function as a pump to support a physiological circulation. The syndrome of chronic heart failure is characterized by symptoms such as breathlessness and fatigue and signs such as fluid retention. Left-sided or right-sided heart failure patients with left-sided heart failure will present with dyspnea, coughing, and expiratory white frothy sputum. Failure of the left ventricle causes reduced stroke volume, congestion in the left ventricle, left atrium, and backflow into the pulmonary circulation. This increased pressure in the pulmonary circulation causes dyspnea, orthopnea at rest, pulmonary edema, fatigue, dizziness, and confusion. Left-sided heart failure commonly leads to right-sided heart failure. Right-sided heart failure can be caused by left-sided heart failure, chronic lung disease, pulmonary embolism, or pulmonary stenosis. Patients with right-sided heart failure have clinical indicators of venous congestion, including edema to ankles, abdominal distension, pleural and abdominal ascites, weight gain or weight loss, and raised jugular venous pressure. Systolic heart failure. Left systolic heart failure is caused by pump failure with reduced systolic function of the left ventricle. The heart's pumping ability is indicated by reduced left ventricle ejection fraction, LVEF, resulting in reduced cardiac output. Diastolic heart failure. Diastolic heart failure is heart failure with preserved systolic function of the left ventricle. Left ventricular filling in diastolic heart failure is reduced because of increased stiffness of the heart muscle. Cardiac output may be reduced in spite of normal pump function. A consequence is increasing pressures causing pulmonary and systemic congestion. Diastolic heart failure is a common condition in the older population. Evidence-based nursing care requires that an accurate diagnosis has been made by the medical team. The following investigations are required to establish the etiology of the heart failure. 12-lead ECG to reveal ischemia and arrhythmias. Chest X-ray to establish if the heart is enlarged. Echocardiogram indicates any systolic and/or diastolic dysfunction and provides the ejection fraction percentage indicating the severity of the heart failure. A blood test with elevated value of a hormone N-terminal brain natriuretic peptide, pro-BNP, is a sign of heart failure and a marker for diagnosis. The hormone is activated by the heart by increasing preload or stimulation of stretch receptors in the heart. The severity of heart failure is classified in function classes compiled by New York Heart Association. Class 1, no limitations. Class 2, mild heart failure, slight limitation of physical activity. Patients are comfortable at rest. Ordinary physical activity results in fatigue, breathlessness, and palpitations. Class 3, moderate heart failure, marked limitation of physical activity. Comfortable at rest, less than ordinary physical activity leads to symptoms. Class 4, severe heart failure. Inability to carry out any physical activity without discomfort. Symptoms are present at rest. Nursing management of the heart failure patient. The aim of nursing management is to monitor the health status of the patient, including the hemodynamic status, promote self-management, improve quality of life, provide education for the patient and their family, reduce unnecessary admissions to acute care. The patient will have regular observations of respiratory rate, pulse rate, oxygen saturations, sitting and standing blood pressure, and temperature recorded. Blood pressure should be monitored continuously in the acute phase. Blood pressure may be elevated or reduced, and cardiogenic shock can occur with a blood pressure below 90 millimetres of mercury systolic, which can be seen in left ventricular failure due to myocardial infarction. Heart failure patients can have a rapid heart rate due to the body compensating for a reduced cardiac output. Respiratory assessment should be conducted for evidence of orthopnea, breathlessness when lying down, and paroxysmal dyspnea, sudden waking in the night due to acute shortness of breath. Patients should be nursed in an upright position, supported by 3 or 4 pillows due to their acute shortness of breath. If necessary, oxygen therapy should be administered as prescribed. 12-lead ECG. Cardiac specialist nurses will observe for cardiac arrhythmias, particularly atrial fibrillation and heart block. Central venous pressure readings will be taken by cardiac specialist nurses. Due to increased preload, the veins in the neck can become engorged. Normally, neck veins are barely visible in a sitting position or 45 degrees. In heart failure patients with right-sided heart failure and elevated central venous pressure, bulging neck veins can be seen. Temperature should be monitored to assess for signs of chest infection or urinary tract infection, which can exacerbate the patient's symptoms. Daily weights will be recorded and action will be taken if weight has increased over the last 3 days by 2 to 4 kilos or 4 to 8 pounds. A rapid increase in weight can indicate that the patient is becoming fluid overloaded. A physical assessment will also be made to examine for pitting peripheral edema, sacral, abdominal and pulmonary edema. A strict fluid balance should be maintained whilst the patient is in the acute phase of the illness. If necessary, a fluid restriction of between 1.5 to 2 litres a day will be maintained. Blood samples will be taken to examine for urea and electrolytes, liver function and full blood count to assess for anemia. Anemia in heart failure patients can lead to increased morbidity and mortality. Nutritional assessment. Nutritional assessment, for example the MUST score, should be undertaken to ascertain nutritional status. Pressure ulcer assessment should be completed using the local policy. Patients may be on bed rest during the acute phase of the illness and are therefore at risk of developing pressure ulcers. Additionally, patients with peripheral edema can have fragile, leaking skin. Cognitive ability can be impaired due to hypoxia and disturbed sleep. The nurse should assess how to ensure effective communication is implemented to support the patient. The nurse should assess, plan, implement and evaluate the nursing care that the patient requires with activities of daily living whilst promoting patient independence. Management of acute heart failure. Comprehensive NICE guidance on managing the patient with acute heart failure is available at the following link. Evidence-based medications in heart failure. It is important that an echocardiogram is carried out prior to commencing heart failure medication to assess the type of heart failure the patient is presenting with. In all types of heart failure, the following medications may be prescribed. Diuretics, to relieve congestive symptoms and fluid retention. The diuretic will be titrated up and down according to the symptoms. Beta blockers are recommended for all patients with left ventricular systolic dysfunction unless otherwise contraindicated, for example by asthma or bronchospasm. These are used to counter the effects of the sympathetic nervous system. The fall in cardiac output caused by the failing heart activates the SNS, a response aimed at elevating blood pressure to ensure vital organ perfusion. This is mediated via the adrenergic system. The stimulation results in peripheral vasoconstriction, which increases afterload, increased heart rate and myocardial contractility. Peripheral resistance means the heart has to work harder, generating further stress on the ventricular wall. The increased heart rate means filling of ventricles and coronary arteries is less efficient. Angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers act to block the effect of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Like the SNS, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system is activated by a sudden drop in blood pressure or circulating volume, for example, hemorrhage, with a response designed to preserve blood flow to the kidneys. When the heart is failing, the reduced cardiac output acts as a trigger to stimulate the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, as there is less circulating blood to the kidneys. The system works rapidly to raise blood pressure and retain salt and water in the following way. Renin acts on angiotensin to produce angiotensin 1. This is then converted to angiotensin 2, a vasoconstrictor which causes a rise in blood pressure and the release of aldosterone. Aldosterone promotes the reabsorption of sodium and water. Aldosterone is also detrimental as it causes myocardial fibrosis. Antidiuretic hormone is also activated, causing vasoconstriction and retention of water and sodium. Initially, the effect is to increase the cardiac output, but only for a short time, as the increased fluid volume eventually means the heart has to work harder, which eventually impairs the function further. Additionally, heart failure patients may be prescribed anticoagulants, aspirin. Intravenous inotropic agents can be used in the short term in acute heart failure. Comprehensive NICE guidance on medications used in heart failure is available at the following link. Promoting patient self-care. The nurse should ensure that patients and their families are offered the following information. Information about the disease and treatment, symptoms and context of daily activities. Provide guidance about medications, their effects and side effects. Provide guidance about non-drug treatments, for example, reduced salt diet, daily weight measurement, physical activity, alcohol consumption, travel information, vaccines, smoking cessation, and sexual activity. Inform on how to seek help if there is any change in the patient's condition. If available, refer to the Heart Failure Specialist Nurse Service for ongoing monitoring and education. Evidence indicated that patients with support from a heart failure specialist nurse have shown increased survival, improved quality of life, and fewer hospitalizations. Adult life support. Cardiac pulmonary resuscitation. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, can be a life-saving intervention when a person has suffered a cardiac arrest as a result of respiratory arrest, myocardial infarction, drowning, electric shock, or brain damage. The assessment of the condition requiring CPR should commence as quickly as possible, as this impacts on the patient's outcome. It is vital to commence chest compressions immediately to maintain cardiac output and respirations to maintain oxygen supply. Full guidance on adult life support is available at the link below. Exercises. Draw the heart and provide a diagrammatic representation of the coronary circulation. What is the difference between systolic and diastolic blood pressure? What is the relationship between the blood pressure and age and what causes this? What is heart failure? What are the two main causes of heart failure? Do you know any symptoms of heart failure? Circulatory shock is a serious acute condition with severe reduced renal blood flow and inadequate oxygen and nutritional supply to the tissues. Describe how a circulatory shock may occur. When do you start CPR? Outline the algorithm in basic life support.